For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. You can learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. The morning show is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome back to our program, if not to our studios quite yet, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, Director of the Clawson Center, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers and journals across the country and in some other countries as well, and more to the point, a monthly visitor to the morning show to offer his thoughts and analysis of an array of current events and issues and concerns. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, Professor Berg, it's always a pleasure. It's nice to be invited back sometimes.
Well, glad we
can. Yeah. Somewhere, yes.
Yeah, glad to have this conversation, even if virtually. Maybe we could just start out by having you talk about what a strange summer it has been for you. I know from many of our past conversations that typically the summer is when you often spend at least some time journeying to other countries, and I strongly suspect that you've had no opportunity to do any of that. Being somewhat stranded, I should think. Tell us more about what your summer has been during this time of COVID-19.
Well, there are opportunities, but also difficulties, and I'm not so much inclined. I've been fortunate to stay on the invitation list for a place called Ditchley Park near Oxfordshire, a conference center that we worked with very closely when I worked in Chicago. It was good for the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations and good for them. Ditchley is a country home that was transformed into a serious meeting place for discussion of foreign policy in the 1950s, reflecting the traditional special relationship between Britain and this country and the nature of foreign policy leadership during the war and through the Vietnam War. That's not just my opinion. It was the usual suspects from the northeastern United States who tended to be quite active with Ditchley. Kingman Brewster, longtime head of Yale, and Elliot Richardson, a Massachusetts Republican who was extremely active and influential, especially during the Nixon years. And that mostly WASP, mostly Republican. Northeastern establishment, Sir Reg Hibbert, the director of Ditchley, customarily was a senior diplomat who was the last, as the last post would run the conference center. Reg was a very active fellow, to put it mildly. His last post had been ambassador to France, which is particularly challenging for our British friends as well as us, and particularly important. And he showed up in Chicago one day, and he developed alliances with us, the group, as I recall, in California, and with the Southern Center for International, the Southern Center for International Education and Studies in Atlanta. And ours would be very durable. We would have lectures on each side of the Atlantic alternating, and in terms of networking and ultimately fundraising, it was very helpful to us and helpful to the British because the world was changing a lot in the 80s. Sir Reg was much more like a British Army officer than a British diplomat. He was in the best sense of both. And it was very good working with him, a very straightforward man. He'd be very demanding man, rather undiplomatic on occasion. But the Ditchley people have been kind enough to keep me on my list, on their list, and my involvement there has given the college some very good visibility. Tom Clawson, and during my first year as at Carthage, Greg Campbell especially, and also our longtime provost, Kurt Piepenberg, encouraged the involvement. So they didn't have an in-person lecture in Oxford. I believe it's still in place. The current British government has a 14-day quarantine period if you come into Heathrow Airport, and for Americans still currently. So also, Ditchley canceled their in-person lecture, but they did it online. And in fact, very impressive, they have the places much more staffed by tech experts and computer experts from the Foreign Office than by traditional diplomats. And actually one of the best online presentations I've seen in terms of the visuals, as well as the substance, was the Ditchley lecture this year. So it brought home to me very dramatically how through innovation, as we're all learning, you can really get around lots of practical problems. So I didn't get there, but I did get there. I usually use it as an opportunity to do some research, and I didn't do that. But because we've been isolated, I've been getting a lot more writing done. I write a weekly column, as you were kind enough to mention, that started with our friend, the late Howard Brown, longtime owner and publisher of the Kenosha News, and also a very supportive Carthage trustee. Thanks to him, I finally got in the door at Scripps Howard News Service. And after they were ruthlessly abolished about a decade ago, I managed to find my way into Gatehouse Media, and then currently Gannett, long established news service and newspaper and news organization, a little different from old time Scripps Howard. But I, thanks to our current situation, I've been able to get the column done without scrambling, you know, starting late at night and into the morning to meet the deadline. And I've been getting other writing done. So I could go on and on and on. Greg, perhaps a function of our isolation, but that's what I've been up to.
Very good. Up to some good things. That's good to hear. I know that
of course we all got a crash course in virtual learning and online teaching in our spring term, thanks to Carol Sabar and Chris Grugel and others at our very fine, really outstanding Carthage Library. I've been able to continue that education this summer. Some other things have come up at the college, but I've been plugging away at, as you know, but I've been plugging away at learning online. It's been, I think it's a real tonic for all of us. So I'll try to shut up at this point. Thank you.
Well, just for a moment, because I'll ask you a question, and then I hope you'll answer that. So one of your most recent columns was concerning what, at least the headline I read, was The Revenge Memoir of John Bolton. That's how your column, the headline characterized it, John Bolton's Revenge Memoir, which is, of course, titled The Room Where It Happened. That takes a line from the famous musical Hamilton. But I think what was really interesting about your column is that you didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about the memoir as much as you talked about John Bolton and Donald Trump and what sort of an ill-paired match they were. And in a sense, it makes it no surprise that there was eventually a rupture. And it also makes it no surprise that Bolton has chosen to write a book like this. But just tell us a little bit about what you think is important for us to know about these two men and why they were so seriously at odds with one another.
Well, there is an expression, the greatest thing since fusion, when two very aggressive personalities or more with large egos a strong sense of themselves come together. Bolton's book, it's very personal. He deals very little with policy in any disciplined sense. And there's a lot about President Trump and a lot of complaints about the president. And there's a lot more about John Bolton. The book is really a me, myself, and I celebration of himself, which seems to be how he's gone through life. He stands out even among Washington types for the those characteristics. I do book reviews, and including in my column. And so the publisher has sent me a copy of the book, which I really appreciate. So it was an opportunity. I've been able to write and publish in substantive terms about the National Security Advisor and the National Security Assistant, so I have some interest in it. Bolton's book is rather long, but it's also quite short. I mean, it's basically a celebration of himself. And if you want to learn about the specific conflicts of the Trump administration beyond personalities, the emphasis on conflict and strain, and if you want to get some insight into the atmosphere of the current administration, the book is worthwhile, but I wouldn't recommend spending a lot of time with it.
Right. So just explain to our listeners the nature of their perpetual conflicts. I mean, in what ways would they be in serious conflict with one another?
Well, just by definition, it's a National Security Advisor's a staff position. It's not formally established by statute. The National Security Act in the Truman administration legislated at National Security Council, but it's basically a staff role. It was a very far-sighted way for the Truman White House and government to try to come to grips with the emerging Cold War. It was an entirely new environment for us. We were a historically isolationist nation and avoided entangling alliances till the Second World War. So the history and structure of the National Security Council is extremely important. The basic policy conflict between Bolton and Trump is concerning military intervention overseas. And the book is fairly interesting in that regard, though it's nothing you can't find online in the readily available media. Bolton is a notorious interventionist. He wants to use force against North Korea. He wants to use force against Iran. Whenever there's a conflict, he's quick on the trigger in the post-Cold War world. And I imagine he was probably the same way during his youth when he had a couple of jobs in the Reagan administration. It is a very theoretical approach to warfare, which characterizes some people, especially in the academic world, more than certainly those who've served in the military. President Trump was elected in part because he promised to reduce overseas military involvements in the current, his current idea to withdraw forces from Germany is the latest example of that. Bolton wanted to use armed force against Iran, and the president vetoed that, saying, "I think there's the potential for too many body bags." He said that in regard to Iran and other parts of the world, and Bolton was highly offended by what he felt was a weak approach to foreign policy.
So it was no surprise that there would be a rupture between those two men.
No.
And no surprise that John Bolton then has gone on to write this book.
Quite right. No surprise in either sense. They lasted together more than a year, which is longer than some senior officials have lasted with President Trump. And it's hardly unique. You know, some of us tend to be very critical of the Trump administration, including in the media. To put it mildly, Ronald Reagan had 6 national security advisors. Depends on the personality of the president and the dynamics of the people around him and what's going on in the world. But that was during the height of the Cold War, a more predictable world in that sense. And Ronald Reagan did not have the he had a very different personality, much more of an even-keeled personality. So it's easy to sit on the sidelines and criticize, which I certainly am always glad to do, but it depends very much on the nature of the president and the presidency. As usual, I think outside of Truman, the best national security staff structure was during the Eisenhower administration. When the position was actually divided between a senior general, who Andrew Goodpaster, who I don't think was a general at that point, a colonel, very distinguished military career, in many ways complementary to Ike. He was the implementer. And then there would be a kind of substantive policy advisor and also organizer. Eisenhower had a very large National Security Council staff structure that had two very large committees, the Planning Board and the Operations Coordinating Board. The administration was much criticized, especially by academics at the time, but also others for being too bureaucratic and too much like the military, and we need a livelier, more flexible approach, which President Kennedy brought in and it continued under Johnson. And with 2020 hindsight, a lot of people realize that given the problems and some would say chaos that developed in the 1960s and unexpected things that were serious challenges, most notably the Vietnam War, there was a move back to a more structured environment under Nixon and Kissinger in the at the end of the 60s. So that's a thumbnail sketch. It's a subject I know something about, and unlike some other things that we talk about. And if anybody wants to get in touch, I'd be glad to expand on that. But I think I'm talking even a little more than usual this time.
Well, there's a whole world to talk about, and one of them, speaking of what's going on in the world, is this matter that came to light, I think, since your last visit to the morning show, namely the alleged Russian bounties on American troops in Afghanistan, which was, of course, news that sparked quite a few headlines and a lot of criticism in both directions. Tell us what you know about this, and maybe at the heart of the matter, too, to what extent do these remain alleged matters? I mean, alleged Russian bounties on American troops. I mean, do we know for a fact, or are we fairly certain that, in fact, such a system was in place? And what do we make of that?
No, we, meaning the U.S. intelligence establishment, is not certain. There is money from Russian sources, according to what's been actively leaked to the media. I think it's reasonable to believe that the reports are accurate. There was money from Russian sources that ended up in the bank accounts of some Taliban members in Afghanistan. It could, given the nature of the world we live in, past as well as present, it could have been could well have been planted funds, an effort to try to stir up trouble within Russia or outside of Russia, between Russia and ourselves. I'm instinctively extremely skeptical. It doesn't ring true to me that Putin himself would do this.
What other mischief has President Putin been up to lately that we should know about?
Well, I think some of the things he does are very much in our interest. We tend to demonize people. We tend to think of foreign policy, I guess maybe one reason I've been emphasizing the structure of policy process, I'm talking about the NSC, is we tend to demonize people. We tend to think in very personal terms about policy more than I think many older nations in the world, especially our British friends. And I think we should think in terms of what's verifiable going on in Russia and what is Putin doing that actually is in our national interest. Russian agents, I believe they are, I believe this is directed by Putin and the Kremlin, although there are all kinds of freelancers in their wild, crazy system. They've certainly meddled in elections in this country and in others. And to some extent, Russian security has been involved in killing targeted individuals, certainly within Russia, but also occasionally outside as well. That's bad. On the good side, on the positive side, Putin is a stabilizing force. And I don't believe the alternatives, realistic alternatives. We also, we Americans, good guys that we are, tend to see the world in terms of others want to be Americans, and our system is replicable elsewhere in the world. I know firsthand that was a big factor in our problems in Southeast Asia many years ago. And so we tend to think Putin is bad because his personal characteristics certainly are unattractive, but that there's some kind of Russian Barack Obama who would emerge if only we got rid of Putin or something like that, or a Russian Elliot Richardson for the benefit of older people. The fact is that if Putin went down, we would probably get someone far worse, far more corrupt, in my opinion. and far more right-wing. Communism is, democracy is not taking root, obviously. Putin's been beating it back. But the alternative is not democracy or communism. I think some kind of right-wing, maybe very aggressive fascist and militarist is probably what's most likely to emerge. So Putin has kept stability in Russia. In fact, the Russians have collaborated, especially in the past, in the UN and NATO. This isn't Iraq all over again, the UN and NATO intervention in Afghanistan. They permitted transportation and logistics coordination and other good things in terms of the Allied effort in Afghanistan, which is one reason why I think they didn't put bounties on Americans. Another reason is traditionally Russia and the Soviet Union in Afghanistan are enemies. As many of our listeners know, through a very brutal and bloody coup and intervention in 1979, the Soviets and the Red Army took over Afghanistan, sort of, but they never really did, and they were driven out a decade later. The militants in Afghanistan are particularly conscious of this, and I'd be surprised if Taliban or other, it's not just one group. Again, we Americans tend to see the world as a little more well-organized than it really is. I'd be surprised if anybody among the militant Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan were anxious to work closely with Russia or even take their money. They're not much interested in money, and it doesn't take much money to continue to create instability in Afghanistan. Hmm. That's my thinking. It doesn't ring true. And I believe it's the National Security Agency put a damper on what was leaked, I think, mainly by an entirely too public and an entirely too undisciplined CIA, in my opinion. Intelligence types who perhaps are more concerned about their hatred for President Trump than they are about maintaining stability in Afghanistan.
Let's turn our attention to the Far East, if we could. You wrote a very interesting column about U.S. relations with Japan strengthening at the same time that our relations with China seem to be in decline. Before we talk about Japan, remind our listeners about the ways in which U.S. relations with China have gone a bit sour over the last few months.
Well, there are accusations that, and I believe they're legitimate and plausible, and I think the administration will probably be releasing more evidence in the near future, that China is very actively engaged in very sophisticated, very technological espionage. And they use their companies, Huawei, which is currently being prosecuted by the US government. And other countries are not only cooperating, but coming around to Washington's point of view, the Canadians and the British respectively. But there are others that it in fact is an intelligence gathering arm as well as a very large successful commercial enterprise. The crackdown in Hong Kong, very, very violent suppression of big, gigantic public demonstrations followed by this very authoritarian national security law that just went through the rubber stamp communist legislature in Beijing, and the consequences therefrom currently, but especially in the future. And the more general repression and move toward a more authoritarian system in China. Very provocative statements by Chinese officials going up to President Xi and expressions of hostility and kind of, speaking of big egos in Washington, rather egotistical emphasis on expansionism, seizing specific small territories and also building artificial islands in and around the South China Sea and exacerbating their territorial dispute with other countries. There are things I'm sure I'm leaving out, but there's a whole litany of things that are creating difficulties with China. Specifically, we have shut down a consulate in Houston, which is allegedly a center of this kind of espionage, dealing not just with military subjects, but also with the space program, pharmaceuticals. There is a tremendous concentration of high-tech industry of all kinds in Texas, so it's plausible that that would be a particularly active intelligence center. We because launches occur in the space program from the Kennedy Space Center, still very heavily in the southeast, we tend to overlook the fact that Lyndon Johnson, throughout his career, but especially in the Kennedy administration, and then when he became president, put a tremendous amount of government investment in Texas. President Kennedy made his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, put him formally in charge of the space program, which was, in a distinctive sense, a number one priority, a 180 from the Eisenhower years. The Kennedy emphasis on space meant that Texas became, and still is, a very big center. You have to look beyond the headlines of rocket launches, but what's going on at the Johnson Space Center and what's going on in the high-tech industry generally in Texas is really worth paying attention to. So this Houston consulate thing you mentioned, talking about this, thank you. What's going on in that case will be worth paying attention to.
So in the wake of for all of those reasons, the souring of U.S. China relations right now.
That's a good term.
We see, in a sense, in its place, strengthening ties with our longtime friend Japan, at least long term. In the short term, not actually all that long in the sweep of history, of course, that we were of the bitterest of enemies, but in recent decades have become friends, although with rocky patches here and there. But you point to a number of things that have strengthened ties between the United States and Japan as of late, including a new bilateral trade agreement that you said is limited but important. That's an interesting turn of phrase. Tell us more about the strengthening ties between our two countries.
You're always challenging, Greg, because you read my column so carefully. I don't always remember what I cranked out in as much detail as you do. At the end of September, I think September 25th last year, there was a new bilateral trade agreement announced by the Trump administration. And as usual with contemporary agreements, it's not across the board. I don't know it in detail, but in terms of designated important trade areas, we are expanding very significantly our trade with Japan. They have been and remain one of the most protectionist countries in the industrialized world. It's a very, very tough market to crack. And for that reason, especially, even today, anything related to trade is important. Also, we turned away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this big Trans-Pacific initiative to try to reproduce the sort of free trade initiatives that characterize the Atlantic area. And in many ways, to me, it's the last few decades have been an effort to build the institutions and partnerships in the Pacific area that we've had with Western Europe, brokered by the British since even before the end of World War II. The Trans-Pacific Partnership was dead in the water before the Trump administration. Hillary Clinton went out of her way to publicly denounce it, even before she got the Democratic nomination in 2016. And it shows that we, actually the Democrats more than the Republicans, have been moving marginally away from free trade. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership is dead. In that context, and given the problems with China, this Japan agreement is especially important. Now, these are complicated matters. I hope it's clear. Thank you for reading my columns so carefully and for keeping me on my toes, to put it mildly.
You're so welcome. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, director of the Clawson Center, and a monthly visitor to the morning show to talk about a whole host of different topics and concerns. Professor Sear, one of the things we should talk about in terms of what has ensued this summer for President Trump, even as he has been trying to contend with COVID-19 and the fallout from the pandemic, is also the matter of some decisions rendered by the U.S. Supreme Court. And certainly not all of them, but some of them have been decisions that have run counter to the president's wishes. And of course, this is a conservative court by a small margin, and I think probably a widespread presumption was that such a court would never oppose the president on any substantive matters, and that has proven to be very much incorrect. I wonder if you could maybe sketch for us this situation of the president and the Supreme Court, and whether or not you have been surprised by any of the decisions that they have handed down that were displeasing to our president.
Well, I'm not surprised in the sense that conflict between the court and the White House or the executive branch and also the Congress is written into the Constitution. That's the way the founders wanted to set up the system. And in that sense, it is working. The Supreme Court, I didn't review the details before coming on this morning, but they in fact rejected a Southern law to try to restrict abortion. And John Roberts, the Chief Justice, voted with the liberals on that. Earlier, he had voted differently on an earlier case, and inch-deep media criticism has, from some quarters, has focused on that. He is the Chief Justice. Precedent is what is extremely important for these individuals if they do their job right, and I don't think he was being inconsistent at all. The earlier vote created a new legal environment. So that's certainly one case that's important. Is there any other that's really struck you?
There was the matter of whether or not civil rights legislation should extend beyond matters of race to involve, for instance, the LGBT community.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about Lyndon Johnson. The legislation passed by the Johnson administration applied to equality for women as well as obviously guaranteed voting rights as well as general civil rights in federal law for African Americans. The decision you're referring to, I think, referred to people who claim discrimination because they're transgendered or otherwise identify with the opposite sex. And that consideration was applied to the law in terms of, you know, banning discrimination on those grounds. I'm not sure how profound a difference that is. A lot of conservative editorials have said, well, the law in the mid-60s applied to, and then the very important Nixon administration efforts to ban sex discrimination applied to biological characteristics of a human being. But the court, in effect, broadened that definition to apply to how a person identifies. And to me, that's perfectly logical and consistent with protecting the freedom of an individual to express themselves as long as they're not being disruptive or breaking the law themselves in another context. I'm obviously not a lawyer, though I'm our very successful mock trial program over the years, led by our colleague, Professor Mike Fegley. I'm not a lawyer, but I get to sit around and listen to a lot of actual and aspiring lawyers. So I've certainly learned a lot, and that helps me do better than I otherwise would do, not just on your program. But that kind of guarantee, I think, is fully consistent with the spirit of those laws. And what Nixon had in mind, poor old Dick Nixon, who liked to feel sorry for himself, unfortunately, still has reason to do so. He actually was pathbreaking in terms of Title IX clause, especially applying that rigorously to sports, among other things, in colleges, so that females have the same kind of opportunities for development and expression that males do. So anyway, that's another decision that the Supreme Court rendered. They've had a very active June and July. Perhaps the most important is Native Americans, that not Roberts, but Gorsuch, I think, who's also supposed to be a conservative. People often change when they get to the Supreme Court. They, in fact, upheld Native American rights to territory by an earlier treaty that was never abrogated by the U.S. government. And that has certainly significant implications for Western and some Midwestern states. So that's a very important law. Very important decision bearing on the law operating differently. Roberts was a very passionate dissenter in that case, and he referred to others. The the long history of our dealing with Native Americans and the abrogation of treaties and passing of overriding laws in Washington, that actually is a very unattractive history from my point of view. So that,
yeah,
that's and finally, the Federal Consumer Protection Agency during the financial crash and recession of 07 to 09, the Congress passed a very comprehensive set of banking regulations and a new consumer protection agency, where Congress put in law that the president could not fire the head of that agency, which is pretty weird and reflects, again, partisanship and division of power in our system. And the Supreme Court overturned that and said, as a part of the executive branch, the president can remove anybody he or she wants.
Another thing that has made this an active summer for the president, particularly over just the last week or two, is the president's decision to deploy federal agents to several major cities across the country, Portland, Oregon being one, Chicago, Illinois for another, I think a couple of others, and potentially Milwaukee, Wisconsin before too long. And this is something that has, of course, garnered a great deal of attention, and particularly you live, I forget if you live in Chicago itself or if you're in one of the suburbs, but
my family home is in one of the Chicago suburbs, sir.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm sure you have particularly followed particularly closely events in Chicago related to this and Mayor Lightfoot's unhappiness with the way in which the federal government has been moving on this. I would be very curious to know about your impressions of what's going on here and why.
Well, I think it's very much a media. It's an opportunity more for the media than a reflection of reality. And of course, very intense and frequently nasty politics in our country today. As everybody must know, Mayor Lightfoot and President Trump regularly trade insults with each other. And I wish both of them would stop. And I particularly think the mayor would be well served not to behave this way. We have federal agents in big cities and small towns and lots of other places all the time. There are FBI offices, DEA offices, federal property is in every significant and insignificant city in the U.S., just in terms of size. So they're always there. That's nothing new. Xi and Trump, showing the political nature of this, the mayor and the president talked on the phone, I think, early last week, and she very publicly and theatrically said, we reached agreement that there will be some federal agents here. It's all politics and media show. End of story.
One of the things that I found interesting is a statement by Attorney General William Barr, essentially in defending President Trump's decision to do this, basically Attorney General Barr saying that the U.S. president needs to be a stronger figure. I mean, not specifically President Trump needs to be stronger, but just as a general concept, the U.S. president needs to play a very central role, and more so than has been the case in recent years, in the opinion of Attorney General Barr. And so I think that's one of the more interesting kind of ramifications of this, is that it perhaps sparks a discussion about what is appropriate for the president to do, and how far do the powers of the president extend when it comes to matters of, for instance, the streets of certain major U.S. cities and so on. Do you have any reaction to Attorney General Barr's comments?
I hadn't heard that or read that comment. It's interesting in terms of modern partisan politics in this country. Again, the Republican Party in our time, that is since the Second World War, has been the party that's emphasized increasingly states' rights, which used to be a Democratic Party theme back when the South was Democratic, overwhelmingly. And it probably has something to do with the fact that the Republicans have now replaced the Democrats as the dominant party in the South. I don't know. I should learn as well as think more about it. But it wasn't too long ago that Dick Cheney was talking very publicly about, and even more privately apparently, about the need for a stronger executive and stronger law enforcement. And Richard Nixon, especially during his second term when he went off the rails and then out of office, thanks to the Nixon tapes, we know that he was constantly increasingly talking about the importance of federal power and federal authority. It's kind of anomalous given the fact that you know, by doctrine and psychology, the Republicans have been overall very much the opposite. So maybe Attorney General Barr's statement reflects that longer trend. Also, obviously, the president is not your typical Republican. He is very much a populist, and certainly quite, he came up a different route, certainly not through the ranks or the Republican establishment. And that's one reason he got elected. And I guess at some level, the Attorney General's statement reflects the president's point of view on these matters.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's also a basic constitutional question we should all think more about, which is part of what you're getting at. The Constitution does not, I believe it refers to militia, but it does not refer to a military, a large standing army or military. That was quite anathema to the founding fathers for good reason. And partly for that reason, I think in this country, we're still struggling with what's appropriate concerning the role of the military and other things. Eisenhower's farewell address, which along with everything else is readily available on YouTube. It's not very long. You can find it easily. It's quite profound and brilliant. And Ike addresses in a very educational way that subject of our relationship with the military. In the current debate, in a way, it shows restraint that nobody is talking about sending in federal troops or even federalizing the National Guard. That happened a great deal during the 1960s when we had very violent, very pervasive, very widespread, not only demonstrations that turned violent, but rioting, arson, looting in major cities. In 1967, Secretary of Defense McNamara, who was really driving this, and President Johnson, of course, sent the 82nd Airborne, which was never sent to Vietnam except during the Tet Offensive following year. The 82nd was sent into Detroit, Michigan, along with elements of the 101st Airborne, I only recently learned, to quell rioting. I believe President George H.W. Bush sent troops into Southern California during the Rodney King riots in 1992. And in 1943, during the height of World War II, federal troops were also sent to Detroit because, again, of widespread rioting. What we're talking about today is very limited property, relatively small groups of people, and essentially protection of federal property, all of which has become a gigantic media story. But people who are really interested in Syria should, you know, think about and learn about the relationship between the federal government and the force. So as usual, you're bringing up a really important question.
In our last couple of minutes, how would you assess the current health of the U.S. economy, given what we are contending with COVID-19 and the damage that has been done? Are you encouraged by the signs of recovery that we seem to be seeing to some extent?
Well, yes, but we're not in a recession, and we never have been. We have widespread unemployment in this country and other countries as a result of the disruption of the public health problem and our reaction to it. But it isn't a recession, as the president likes to trumpet. We have full employment in our economy across the board, quite extraordinary, and it's a good thing that we did, because a lot of people are out of work. But structurally, we have not yet moved into recession. We may. I've been surprised that the markets have held up as well as they have. I was bracing myself for a downturn, but I'm fortunate to have been a good long-term saver and investor at this point in my life, because I sure as hell am lousy at any kind of short-term developments. To actually give you a straight answer for a change, e-commerce, automated manufacturing, which is generally condemned and certainly disruptive for displacing workers, particularly in an industrial state like Wisconsin, but also Illinois, it's actually a benefit in terms of stabilizing production of industrial finished goods, but consumer products of all kinds. Therefore, you can have people staying home and still a lot produced. And of course, e-commerce. E-commerce, not just in terms of Amazon, but the fact that lots of small businesses have been put out of business for going on for decades, not just this year. The other side of that is delivery, buying and selling, exchange relationships have been remarkably unaffected. People are disrupted, but the commerce remains strong, if that's clear. The other side of the globalization that's led, a short-term term for what's led to this terrible public health problem, the other side of it is it reinforces economic stability. Very different during the tremendous Hong Kong flu epidemic in this country in 68, 69, which the media and politicians and lots of other people avoid. Very similar to today. The human cost was tremendous. There was no option of staying at home in that very different economy and environment. And I believe it was one factor that led to the tremendous economic disruptions of the 70s, the long-term continuing unemployment along with inflation, the Vietnam War, and excessive federal spending under LBJ was one reason, and then reinforced by Nixon. And the oil shocks of 73 and 79 were another reason. But I was around during the earlier flu epidemic, and the disruption in terms of the economy was tremendous. You still went to work. It was basically a function of literally hundreds of thousands of American troops coming back on a rotating basis from Vietnam. And it spread very quickly throughout the economy and afflicted, among other people, President Lyndon B. Johnson, who was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. I believe that president was in intensive care for a few days. And then he, of course, survived. But that was a tremendous public health problem. But the dynamics were very different from today. As usual, I'm going on at length, but this time there may be a good reason, because the media obsesses about things, and then they imitate each other, and so everybody knows about 1918, but there's virtually no mention of this important history that is part of the full picture.
Well, we appreciate you, Professor Sear, giving us the full picture and reminding us of important moments in our history that are applicable to the challenges of today. Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, I appreciate you being part of the morning show today, as always, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Well, it's always a pleasure and certainly thought-provoking. Thank you, young man.
And we remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It's archived on our website, wgtd.org, and available as a podcast.